Welcome to the American Overlander podcast. On this episode, we are going to continue talking about the Idaho BDR, but we were joined by Rob from Revere Overland, who was a key companion on this trip for most of the time. And he and Chris and I sit down and start kind of picking up where we left off last time, but with Rob's input and perspective. And this conversation takes us all the way through the end of the Idaho BDR. But on this episode, we're going to get about halfway through because it was a very long conversation. So enjoy this recap of the Idaho BDR with Rob from Revere Overland.
Welcome, welcome, welcome everyone to the American Overlander podcast. I'm your host, Will Fowler, and today we are going to talk about the rest of the BDR. And we are joined for the first time on this BDR re-journey that we've been on with by Rob from Revere Overland. So Rob is joining us from his house, wherever that might be in the country, because he's always somewhere. He's never actually home. Or are you home, Rob?
Yeah, right now back in Kentucky.
Oh, great. Okay. So Rob's coming to us from Kentucky. And to catch everyone up, if you didn't know, Rob did almost the entire BDR with us. We met down in Jarbidge and we went on this crazy adventure together. And so for folks who don't know Rob, maybe you could just catch us up and like, why did you choose to do this with us? And and what was it like for you, like kind of going on a pretty close-knit travel experience with people that you hadn't spent much time with before?
And yeah, did you have an exit strategy for getting away from a couple of possible
guys? Yeah, I'm not smart enough to do that. I'm not smart enough to think, I should come up with an exit strategy. So I'll just meet random people on the internet without kind of taking that into consideration. So the Idaho Backcountry Discovery Route is one of these things I've wanted to do for the longest time. Like, I wanted to do the whole thing, and I've tried it twice before and have run into issues both times. First time was snow, second time was fire. And I talked to you guys about that and said, like, this is a very, very real possibility.
Yep.
Actually, in the last podcast I was on, I think we were talking about it.
That's right. Yeah. In fact, at the end of that podcast, we were talking about the BDR, and that's when you were like, hey, if you guys are doing that, I'd love to give another shot. And we were like, yeah, we'd love to do it with you. And of course, Chris and I thought, well, Rob was just being nice. But then as the year kind of progressed, we kept talking about it, and it turned into a thing.
Yeah. So I invited myself on this trip with you guys because I know you two obviously close knit group, and along comes this strange guy who talks funny. But I think it's one of those things. You watch these people on the internet, you watch these YouTube videos, and you feel like you know them. You know, I know a lot of people have that watching our videos. They come up to us, they talk to us like they know us, and they'll acknowledge that. They're like, oh, I feel like I know you. You have no clue who I am. And the same happens with us. You know, I've watched you two on video, so I feel like I know you both.
Yep.
I feel like you can get a fairly good judge of character. And it's probably similar for you guys as well. I'm assuming you've watched my videos. I don't know. Maybe you don't like them.
Yeah, I've copied your videos. So yeah, I think there's truth to that. I think like people say I feel like I know you. And the truth is they actually do, like to a certain extent, they actually do know you because you're not presenting a character. It's like yourself in these videos. And so I think that's really true. And we had been, you and I had been kind of chatting online, just talking about each other's videos. And we both kind of belong to a feedback group that you and Justin B. McBride started. So we had been communicating about it. So we weren't total strangers, but we never traveled together. So I'm glad to hear you're an optimist with no exit plan.
Yeah. And you never know, because traveling with people, some people are very particular with how they travel. You know, some people want to be up at 6 a.m. on the road to get to X, Y, Z and get to, like, you know, whatever certain destination by this time. And as you probably learned, that's not me.
But you were totally
probably. I was just going to say, and Rob, you probably, as you pointed out during our trip, you learned that Will and I are not actually people. We're skinwalkers.
Yeah. At one point, Rob was like, what is wrong with you guys? You stay up really late, you drink bourbon, you get up really early. Like, how are you functioning?
Yeah. I think you're skinwalkers.
Yeah. But we'd been communicating, we kind of had put this trip together. And at one point you and I did do a little communication on like, maybe some rerouting, because there were some conditions that we weren't sure about, which we're going to talk about here in just a second.
Yeah.
Like there were some passes that were still snowed in that we weren't sure. And we were looking at like the Gaia snow layer and other kind of weather maps. And it looked like the snow was melting, but we weren't sure if we're going to make it through a couple passes. And so we had communicated a bit. So then you show up in Jarbidge and you were really upfront about your like travel preferences. You were like, okay, guys, listen, I don't wake up early. And we're like, thanks for telling us. That's yeah, really nice. Do. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say we're probably, Chris likes to sleep in probably as much as you do in general. At camp, Chris tends to get up a little bit earlier. I just can't sleep in. So I don't think it's a virtue. It's a problem. I just wake up early. So we meet up in Jarbidge. We're on this trip. We meet up in Jarbidge and Chris and I have our kids and then our wives come, and then Kate's parents are there, and we have like 14 people in this group. And I remember this night when we stayed up above Yellow Pine, which we've already covered in this podcast, but I remember hanging out up on the top of that mine on the mountain.
Yeah.
And you were like, I was so impressed because you were like totally at ease, having fun with the kids, chatting with, you know, the grandparents. And I was like, to me, that's like, I think you can tell a lot about somebody and how they kind of adapt to new people. And you were like, it seemed like you were actually enjoying yourself having conversations with these strangers.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, obviously it's a great group of people. You guys are all very tight knit. You know, you spend a lot of time around each other, but you're all very welcoming as well.
Get down. We get into the Salmon River. Elsha made us this zoodle, Thai dish, which was super good. The next morning, was Sunday, and we had to get Kate and Elsha, well, not Elsha, because I guess Elsha was on a break. We had to get Kate back to work because she had to go to work on Monday and she was taking the kids. And so we had plans to make it to Warren and Bergdorf, which is about 60 miles from where we stopped. We had planned to make it there that previous day. So this morning we wake up and we have kind of an extra 60 miles of dirt to figure out. And so we left early. That's the one day that I think we asked Rob to get up early.
And I obliged without complaining.
Totally. You're totally cool about it. I was like worried. I was like, oh no, he's going to be mad. But no, you're totally cool about it. I think we left camp at like 8 o'clock. So we were up at like 6:30.
Okay, this is the point of the podcast where I realized I didn't have the correct microphone turned on. So I found the problem, I fixed it. I never claimed to be the most perfect podcaster, and this is just proof of it. Okay, back to the podcast.
Okay, we're back. Okay, so, all right. So the morning of the North Fork on the Salmon, we leave early. We're driving over these beautiful mountain passes, trying to get into Warren, Idaho. I'm curious, Rod, like, what's your recollection of that drive, that piece of the drive?
If I remember correctly, I was right at the back, so it was mainly dust.
You were in the back for a while.
Yeah, it was, that's a pretty drive, a lot of radio chatting, because we had a big old convoy at that stage, didn't we?
We did, except Kate's parents.
Bunch of Jeeps.
Yeah, there was all Jeeps and one Toyota.
No, I remember we had that deadline, and I know we were talking a lot about gas shortages.
Yeah.
Because we'd run into those issues at the gas station in Yellow Pine. And I think we were talking about, like, will we make it to Warren, or do we have to go find gas somewhere else? Will the gas station be open in the town along the way?
That's one of the reasons that we stayed at that campsite, because we were thinking about pushing into Warren the previous day, but we know that those gas stations aren't like 24
hours. Oh yeah, they close down, yeah.
At like 4:30 or 5 in the afternoon. Yeah. So we just figured we'd call it a day early, which was one of our few early days.
Yeah. I think we deserved it.
Yeah. Yeah. We earned it. I did use my Rotopaxx. So I had 4 gallons of Rotopaxx that I put into my tank that night at that campsite on the river, because I was nervous about making it. I was running on fumes basically.
I would have made it if I hadn't used my, the gas bags, the 5 gallons I put in.
Did you do that at that campsite?
Yep, I did it in the morning of the morning we left.
That's right. Okay, yeah, that's right. I remember that. So we drive into Warren, and then we get to Warren, and it turns out we have hit like flat country, wide open roads, and we don't even get gas in Warren. We decide we've got plenty, and because we know McCall is like 40 miles away or something, like 20 on dirt and 20 on pavement, and so everybody had more than 40 miles range. And so we just kind of beelined through Warren,
hit pavement. And this is something that didn't make it into any of our videos, but was one of the best parts of the trip. It's like we drove into the Kate's parents' cabin in McCall, Idaho, and we did all of our laundry and we took showers. Oh my God, it felt so good. Like it was like starting over again.
Yeah, I do remember stopping at that cabin, just having a shower. It's amazing how having a shower changes you. And then it was good to refresh all the laundry. Obviously, you know, you and Chris had to separate your lacy underwear from everyone else's.
So we hit McCall, then we beelined back to near Borgdorf. And this section of my video, I tried to make it into kind of like a race car sequence. I did a bad job of making it into a race car sequence, but I was trying to capture like how fast we were going, because it was wide open roads, long straightaways, totally flat, super graded. And so it was really predictable road.
Yeah. That's wide open. You can see for miles as well.
Yeah.
Just it's a gravel road.
Yeah. I think that's where the Tundra like really shines. It just so fast and so stable.
And what was that road after Florence?
Yes.
Yeah. We'll talk about that one when we get there. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So we take these roads and these roads kind of empty out into this thing called the French Creek grade. Oh, before we stopped at that bus, and I still can't get the story in that bus. I've researched to the end of the internet, but there's this old bus that's parked on the side of this hill. It was like an overlander bus or an overnight bus. It had a bed in it and somebody never made it out, or the bus didn't make it out. I'm sure they did. That was kind of cool to see. And a lot of people had like signed it and put their, you know, we saw an Overland Bound sticker and things like that.
How do you feel about putting stickers on stuff? Do you think that's vandalism, leaving a sticker on something like that? Are you okay with that?
I think that if it's an abandoned bus like that, like I don't really feel like it's vandalism necessarily, but I think it's really stupid. if you have a YouTube channel, like you stop and you're just opening yourself up to be criticized. Mm-hmm. I remember I brought it up. I was like, hey, maybe we should put a sticker on here or something. And you're like, dude, that's the dumbest thing in the world. Like, have you seen the trolls on the internet? You should not do that.
Yeah. So and what about like, stop signs? Like you see our famous places signs, stickers on those?
No, not only, I don't think
I'm glad you agree with me there.
Yeah. I don't think you should put stickers on signs or any kind of public, property or shoot holes in them. In Idaho, everybody shoots holes in all the signs.
Yeah, that's a Kentucky thing as well. Just driving down the road is a stop sign.
Exactly. Yeah. The French Creek grade is this series of really beautiful switchbacks. They're long hairpin turns across this, I don't know if I'd call it a mountain, but certainly like a foothill. And I think it drops like 1,200 feet in not too far. And so driving it, I was a little
out of nowhere.
Yeah, right. Like, it's like all of a sudden you pull up and it's a drop.
Yeah, I remember you said on the radio, I've got the radio conversation, it's something like, oh, we're approaching something called the French Creek grade. You're just going through forest, and then suddenly that last tree drops away and it's just a huge mountainside and you can see these switchbacks below you. Really cool sight.
Yeah, and when Will was like basically plotting the route and everything, like that, this is a spot that he had brought up and he's like, look at this. And like, he showed me like the hairpin turns.
It's absurd.
I'm like, that's okay. I mean, but you don't really get the full, the full picture until you're actually there and you see that it's not just like a flat, you know, switchback. I mean, obviously, but man, it was amazing.
A lot of times when you're like, when you look at maps as much as we do, you kind of can tell when there's something interesting by the squiggliness of the
trail.
And so when you look at when I looked at the topo on that, and then I looked at just the pattern of the road, I thought, well, this is going to be interesting. It's got to be interesting, but it blew me away when we got there. It was so beautiful and it was so big and so vast, even with our drones, I don't think we really captured it.
I don't because think so,
Our drones would have had to been much farther away to kind of get the whole thing in the lens.
Yeah.
I think we did a pretty good job of capturing like how cool it was, but I was looking at the footage and neither of us had our drones far enough away because we were also driving and trying not to like drive off the ledge.
Right. Yeah, 'cause it was a long way down.
Yeah. But I got a ton of comments on that video. A lot of people were like, what is that place?
Yeah, it's really cool. I really enjoyed that.
I think it took about, I don't know, maybe 30 minutes to drive down. And it empties out into French Creek, and French Creek runs into the North Fork of the Salmon. And my memory was, I think it was probably like 3 o'clock in the afternoon at this point, maybe four. It was really hot. It's like 100 degrees.
So hot, yeah.
And we were going to low elevation. So it was like, I think we were down to like 1200 feet in elevation. So it was just, it felt really, really hot. And then we hit the Salmon River, and this is like the main fork of the Salmon River, and it's wide, it's windy. It just looked so cool and inviting. Like I felt like I cooled off just by seeing the river.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
When
we were driving along, I remember looking at the maps and seeing like just all these campsites dotted along it. It's like one of those would be perfect. And every single one of them was on the river for rafting.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You couldn't get down to
them. They weren't like, you couldn't just like drive up to them or walk up to them. You had to, like, a lot of them were on the other side where there was like no access unless you were on a raft.
And they were all taken anyway. Like everybody was on the river at that time for whatever reason. Will. And
I feel like we talked about this.
Might be why.
We've established that. And then we came across, I can't remember whose idea it was to drive down this road, but we came across, there was like a bunch of like raft vehicles parked on the side of the road. And there's this little teeny access road. And somebody was like, well, why don't you just drive down? Maybe there's something down there. I was like, okay. And we drove down, and it was this campsite that was just barely big enough for the three rigs. But it was like, I don't even know how to explain it. It was like an all-inclusive resort is what it felt like. It like had everything there, had a fire pit, had private beach, white sand beach.
There was like an eddy, like right there. The water was like just super still. It was kind of swirling and just
such perfect. A good spot. I remember that once. I'm assuming it was Chris that was the one that insisted we drive down and check it out. Because I remember the only reason we even noticed it is because we pulled over to bring my drone in. We pulled over like right next to this little thing, and it was so hidden. Like there's no way we would have seen it if we were just driving along at 30, 40 miles an hour. The fact that we stopped, the only reason we saw
it. Yeah, it was easy to miss.
Yep.
Yeah, tiny little road.
Everybody else had missed it too.
Yeah, so
it's, the road down was just gnarly enough to keep like a passenger car from driving down there probably. Oh, yeah. But
yeah. It was a good breakover angle down into it from what I remember. Yeah.
I think just that was my favorite, or maybe one of my top two of that trip. It was such a good campsite. And I remember those jet boats that were driving by.
Yeah.
And they, like, the video does not capture the sound that those things make. It's like, I don't know, they have these big V8s or something, and they just, it's like, whoa, and it echoes in the canyon across all the mountains, and you hear them coming. They have these huge American flags on the back. it's almost like insulting. Like they're so loud. And so it's like America coming down the river. But those boat drivers were really talented. Like they would, you know, they're like spinning around doing different things on the river, and they're running supplies to all the rafters that are up there. And I just remember sitting there having the old fashions that we had got from Yellow Pine, sitting
on the beach.
On the beach.
With toes in the sand.
Mm-hmm.
Super hot, so but water's right there. So you have that nice cool breeze off the water.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was, I would agree with you. That was my favorite campsite from the entire trip. Maybe, you know, in terms of scenery, maybe not the prettiest, but just the whole atmosphere of it. The fact that it was just hidden away right on the water with your own private beach is just, you can't beat that one.
I'm not sure we'll ever get it again. I think it was like one of those, it was like in the moment, it was just right. But if we go back, there'll be somebody there or something like that. You know what I mean?
Those,
probably is
those jet boat, one of the jet boat, what do you call them? Pilots, drivers. One of them commented on my video and said that was me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
What are the captains? Chances?
The jet boat captains, maybe?
Are captain? Yeah, we'll go with captain.
Maybe they can save that spot for us for next time. We'll say, hey, you know, could you just like throw some stuff out there for us? We're going to be here in these dates.
Yeah.
Throw something out.
Bring some supplies in.
Yeah, right. Yeah, free the bourbon. Yeah. So we had a great night. I tried to record an informational video on this flat pack grill and I just couldn't do it. I remember I just gave up. We were just having a good time and like never have a glass of bourbon before you great. Try to record something. It was the worst. And then
it did make great ribs on it that night. This was like the first time we used it.
Those were good ribs. We had ribs twice on that grill. Those were good ribs. These are ribs. Ribs that we had later were not as good, but those were really good.
Yeah, the second ones like looked really good, but they were super fatty. Anyway,
that's a new food to me on the trail. Those kind of pre-made ribs that you just heat up. I'm doing that. That's a new thing. So then we have a great night. No one really wakes up early the next morning. We get on the road. We cross over the Salmon River. We climb up some really beautiful roads that showcase some of those Salmon River mountains. And then we get into what I think is maybe the spookiest part of the trip, which was the woods leading into Florence.
Yeah. We took several attempts. Remember the woods, the road that we were following, the Idaho Backcountry Discovery route, the actual trail that we were following just got narrower and narrower. Do you remember I was leading at that stage. And I took one of the turnoffs, and there was just wood scattered everywhere. It looked like a horde of beavers had run through and gone crazy. And I remember at that stage, we decided we'd backtrack a little bit. We took a slightly different route there.
Yeah. Because we thought we were going to have to cut too much.
Yeah. So many trees.
The signage wasn't good either.
Yeah. I remember when we backtracked to a sign that pointed towards Florence, because the way we'd gone didn't.
But I think that we were on the actual BDR, and so then we got off the BDR, I think, and took kind of the other road into Florence. Maybe we were backwards. In any case, we get into these woods to Florence, and it's still it's really fun to drive because it's narrow. It's just like I would say like an extremely unkept old forest road. There's no like real obstacles in it, but there's some really interesting washouts and it's windy and you kind of have to dodge a couple things, but it's nothing that's like white knuckle or anything like that.
Right. We did have to cut
the creaking trees.
The one that sounded like it was going to come down on us. That was when we were cutting a tree, wasn't it? Cause it was just a little too tight for the tundra in a couple of spots.
We got out to cut a tree and, we were like mid sentence talking and all of a sudden we hear this crack and then we look up and we realize that like there are widowmakers everywhere. And I hadn't really even looked up until then. And so that's when we were all like joking around, having a good time, playing around with the cameras. And we were like, hey, why don't we get the hell out of here? We might be in danger.
Yeah. That was also where Sam Squinch was on your video. Sasquatch.
That's right. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Somebody pointed out that there was like a Sasquatch in a clip of the video. There's like this little dark figure that right at the end, and this always impresses me, dude, that people watch with that much detail. And Chris and I went back, cause I was like freaked out. Chris and I went back and we saw it and I was like, oh my God, what is that? And so then I went back to the raw footage. And it was not a Sasquatch. It was actually, I think it was either Chris's rig or your rig. And it was like a windy road ahead and it just barely came into frame, but it was far enough away you couldn't see any detail. Anyway, it wasn't Sasquatch.
I think I'm going to choose to believe that it was Sasquatch.
It really felt like Sasquatch.
It really did look like it.
It was there for sure. And like, I think there were like witches out there. I mean, that's where the skinwalkers were. I mean, it was the spookiest wood. And we were there like midday and people were like, people commented on the video on mine anyway, and they're like, you guys are a bunch of wusses. What's wrong with you? And it's like, well, when you spend as much time out, I'm not trying to be a tough guy here, but when you spend as much time out there, like we do, like you do just develop a sense for things. And it's like, I think we should just get through this because it did feel spooky. And like, I think those are like your natural senses telling you to be alert.
The scariest thing there are the gold prospectors.
Yes, thank you for saying that because you came across the guy.
I did, yeah. He actually he seemed really friendly.
Yeah, he was just, they're friendly after they know you're not trying to get their gold.
Yeah, well, I just said, like, we're just driving through, you know, we're just out here exploring nature. We're not exploring for gold. We're not here on your turf.
Yeah.
He just, I think he had, or his brother had a claim there, and his brother was supposed to be coming out to meet him like a week previously to help him. He'd just been out there by himself looking for gold the entire time. Hadn't had any luck.
That's so weird to me. I mean, so that guy was out there on his own, alone in those spooky woods looking for gold. I mean, just so many possible terrible stories.
Yeah, and that could come from that. That's a very long way from the nearest town, like a very long way from the nearest paved road. Because
I think Riggins is probably the closest town, Riggins, Idaho, which is down on the Salmon River, and that's, I don't know, 40 miles probably at least. Mm-hmm. Most of that dirt.
It took us a long time to get to paved road. When we went north. To get out of there, probably went northeast, you think?
Yeah.
Took a really long time to get to paved road.
So we got in Florence. Florence is, there's two Florences, as we found out. There was Old Florence and New Florence. And New Florence still had a few structures left. And there was this kind of mud bog. What was it? It was called like Mud Bog Road or something like that.
Quicksand Road, I think.
Quicksand Road. I mean, that's very appropriate.
Yeah.
That's where, actually, Rob, you broke your bumper.
Did I break it there?
I think that's where you cracked your rear bumper.
Yeah, going through that. I do remember that. Yeah, that was actually, so I think there was actually three Florences. I think there was like the original, because there was the Florence where all the signs were. Mm-hmm. Then there was New Florence where there were some, like, a couple of prefab buildings. And then there was like Florence and a half, which is where the first place we stopped, which was where where that mud pit was.
Right. There was a cool old jail there, and there was some other old cabins and things. Probably, I can't remember when it was like officially abandoned. It looked like there's still some people who kind of spend some time out there, like in that community close by. But I think it was like maybe the 30s or something like that, that they had been kind of officially abandoned. And then so those were kind of cool. We had lunch there, and then we drove over to the cemetery, which is a total surprise for us. And that's where there are some informational signs. And I have to apologize to Rob on this, because Rob did this really great take to the camera. He was like, "Hey, Will, can you film me on this?" And I was like, "Of course, man. Like, we're bros. I'll film whatever you want." And he does really great informational take to the camera on Florence, and like, you had like the first courthouse and the first Masonic lodge and the first library and the first school district and all these things that were just total discoveries to us. And I was like, yeah, I totally got it. And we got back, I had pressed record in the wrong direction. And all I got was like the 3 seconds before Rob started talking.
Yeah, I've done that. Sorry. I've done that before. So you're forgiven. You know, you like record the floor a little bit, and then you point it at the person's face. You're like, you're ready, and then you stop recording.
Yeah.
And then right as they get done talking, that's when you press record again and start recording, and then walk off and you get a nice recording with the floor again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I totally pulled one of those. Yeah. So I think we covered the graveyard pretty great in the video. It was, although you didn't cover it too much, but it was really cool to see those graves.
Yeah, I think you stopped and you recorded yourself there. You talked about some of the stories there, because obviously the whole town had a lot of stories, things we'd never heard of. You know, like you say, all these firsts, all of Idaho's firsts. So obviously it's an important settlement. I hadn't done a lot of research on it. If I had never heard of it before you went on this trip, but when I came back, I like to do a lot of research. Like, I go really in depth to the places we visited, so I can include some of the information in the videos. And turns out this town was one of the most infamous towns in the West. Like, just completely lawless.
It is like your classic Western outlaw town. Like, so I got to tell the story about Cherokee Bob, because after this trip, I went back and did some research, and I just finished reading, just like last week or 2 weeks ago, finished reading The History of Idaho as written in 1912. And it covers these stories. So a lot of that's oral history that the author was just kind of writing down for the first time ever. And the story about Cherokee Bob. So Cherokee Bob was part of this other crew that came into town. Part of it's a much deeper story on that dude and how he got to Florence. However, he gets to Florence. He basically steals a saloon from somebody. And the town also had like upstanding citizens. They were trying to have a town. And there was a night where they had a ball. They threw a big ball in Florence. And Cherokee Bob, his companion was like a prostitute that had become his kind of main prostitute person. And he brought her into the ball, and she was all kind of super painted. I don't know, whatever. She looked very different than everybody else. And all of the people there were like, look, we're not cool with this. We're not cool with, like, this is not a ball for prostitutes. Like, you know, and that Cherokee Bob dude, he's a bad person. Like, can we please just get him out of here? So this guy, I think Talbot or Halbert, who's kind of like, I don't know, maybe he's an upstanding citizen in the town, right? And he comes and he says, you got to go. Sorry. And Cherokee Bob gets so mad. He makes basically a death oath for this guy. He says, I'm going to kill you and I'm going to kill your family because you threw me and my woman out of this ball. And this guy, Talbot or Halbert or whatever his name was smart enough to know that he had to get the drop on him. And so basically he got the drop on Cherokee Bob and shot him dead in the street. The next day, and I don't know what happened to his lady of the night, but, it was like the conflict actually happened over a dance hall and a woman, which is not super like surprising, but it's just interesting to know those details. So anyway, killed the guy, the bad guy was kind of, you know, buried, and, the saloon went back to whoever. And that was like one of, I don't know, two or three dozen terrible stories. That one had more of a happy ending, but it still ended in like somebody getting shot.
Yeah. I read, forgot about that. As I said, I read, like, you can look up old newspaper clippings, and there was one where someone had gone there and then written a letter home to the whatever newspaper it was in Idaho, just basically saying this place is terrible. People get shot on the street basically daily. Hey, you don't turn around and look. You just keep walking down the street if you hear gunshots.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. What a different time. You know, that's just so crazy. And there was no law, because like, what law could get out to Florence, Idaho? This is how it was so different back then. It was lawless because there was no enforcement of the law in those times, except for what the citizens of the town would allow or not allow, because there wasn't really a legal system that mattered. There was no, we're going to send a sheriff from where?
Right.
Like, it was just so remote. Anyway,
it's the frontier at that stage.
Yeah. And that town, that, and that place felt all of those things, all of that history, it really kind of landed. So then we get to these roads that you just started Baja-ing. Like at one point, Rob basically went like, woohoo on the radio. He was like, I like these roads. And then we didn't see him. I didn't see you for like 45 minutes. Like, you were gone.
Yeah. That's the kind of road after that is the kind of road that Tundra was made for, that whole suspension on there. It's just tuned for, you know, it's slightly bumpy. Couple of whoops, couple of potholes, and you just don't feel it in that truck.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. And you were so fast. Our Jeeps were like very slow and cumbersome on that stuff, because they're a little tippy. No.
I know. You know, my wife's got a Jeep. They're two very different vehicles. The Jeep is an incredible vehicle, but not so good for that kind of stuff.
Yeah, we drive a lot slower on that stuff. So then we hit pavement for a bit, and we work our way towards Elk City. And I have since heard, I don't know if this is true or not, but I've since heard that gas station is now closed, which really messes up the BDR because there's no gas.
If you're going to do that section, you have to take extra fuel if you've got. I mean, I don't think I used my extra fuel, but I was on fumes by the time we got into the next town.
Yeah, into Lolo. Yeah, you were. Yeah, you like, in fact, you had less miles left on your computer than we had on the road, but then it kind of caught up and you.
It did. Yeah, I remember like it was down to, I think I had 7 miles range left by the time we got to, what was the name of that town? Darby.
Darby.
So I was pushing it with mine. If you have less than 300 miles range on a good day, I think you've got to take extra gas.
I think so too. So on this trip, we gassed up and we had plenty of range, or at least we did, because I gassed up.
Yeah, you too, Dick. I refused to pay $8 a gallon.
You were like, I'm not doing this. And then we got on the Magruder, and Magruder, like, I was so excited about the Magruder because it's an iconic trail, especially if you're from Idaho. It's super, there's just so much wrapped up in it. And it's a word that you hear growing up, the Magruder Corridor and the Lolo Motorway. You don't really know what it is. And in planning this trip and thinking about it, you know, there we have these two, I think, national treasures in Idaho, which is the Frank Church Wilderness of No Return. And by the way, the river of no return is the Salmon River. And then the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness, which is just north of that. And I think together they comprise like 5 million acres of protected wilderness areas. And this is the one road. Maybe there's...
Yeah, I think maybe, it's the only road between the two.
The only road that goes through all the way through from one side to the other. And so you have like 3 million acres to the north, to the south of you, and 2 million acres to the north of you of protected land. And so, you know, to say I was excited about driving in there is an understatement. I was like giddy to get in there, and it was not what I expected at all.
Yeah, it's obviously it's a significant road. Like it's got historical importance, and then it's notable because it is, I don't know if it is the most remote road in the lower 48, but it is definitely one of the most remote roads.
Yeah. I think it depends on how you define most remote. I think on some lists it's the most remote. Like if it's like miles to paved road or miles to services or however you define that, but it's up there. It's one of the top.
Basically, I mean, there is nothing to the north and nothing to the south. It's just that one little strip of road.
So and it's significant. And
Yeah,
you do. You feel like you're out there. And it's the way that they have it constructed is that there's not really a lot of opportunities to drive off the road either. So like there's not a lot of spur roads. There's not a place to go find like a cool dispersed camping site. They have like designated camping spots along the route. And those are the places that you can camp, and you're not supposed to camp anywhere else.
Yeah.
And so it really also feels like you're on an island the whole way through, because you can't really leave the route. It feels like you're being escorted through the wilderness a little bit.
Yeah, it is very linear. It's not like you're exploring. You know, when you're out deep in the middle of the woods around Florence, you feel like you're exploring because you can go, you know, all these different little roads off to the side, and some of them are really overgrown. Some of them got trees across them, and then there's the Magruder, which is a relatively well-maintained road that just goes straight through.
Yeah. And so two things really surprised me. I'm interested to know like what surprised you guys about Magruder, but two things really surprised me. One was the fires that had gone through. Like I was not prepared for how much of that had been scorched. And it's still beautiful, but it's almost like it's hauntingly beautiful. And actually as a result, which is the other really surprising thing, was the amount of bear grass that was growing I felt like I was on a different planet. It was like nothing I'd ever seen before. Yeah. It was huge. They're 4 feet high. They're in these clumps and there were millions of them.
Oh yeah.
Millions. It was insane.
Made some really cool shots getting all that bear grass in and up around, you know, the place we camped. It was in a big burn area. You know, we're talking like I don't know about hundreds of thousands, but tens of thousands of acres burned in that area. And then just bare grass, little yellow flowers in every direction. So thick. Yeah. And then the same up by that fire tower, the first one we stopped at.
Yeah, I think it's called the Green Mountain? And I think next time we go back, that might be the place to camp. They have a fire ring up there. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we stopped and we found this... we came across this jeeping couple and they had just come down from Burnt Knob and they're from that area. They reached out to me on the comments, by the way. They saw the video. And they were saying, you got to go up there. You have to do it. It's amazing. And they were like, it's a really tough road, but it's totally worth it. And so because of that, I was like, you guys, we should give this a shot because we had not planned on doing it. And we turned off onto the road and I think it's like 3 miles.
Yeah, it's like even then we weren't sure. If they hadn't told us, we definitely would have driven right past it because we wouldn't have known. But even after they recommended it, like you've got the radio conversation in your video, you can hear like, we're not sure we really want to do this.
Yeah. And it wasn't because the road was so technical. It wasn't like, I don't know if my rig can handle this. It was like, do we have time for this right now?
It's just super slow.
It's going to take forever. Yeah. And so it was such a great moment because like, we were all very unsure that we should be driving up there, that we didn't have the time for it, that it was going to be a time suck. And it was all of those things. And then we got up to the top and we were like, oh my God.
Yeah. Wow.
Wow. I mean, yeah. I don't know if I've ever seen anything quite like that. I mean, I've seen some cool stuff. You've seen some amazing stuff, but that's up there.
Yeah. Without a doubt, worth it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the first thing you said when you got out of the truck. You're like, this is definitely worth the drive.
Yeah, for sure. I don't think you camp. Well, I know you can camp up there. I don't know if the three of us could have comfortably camped up there. There wasn't a ton of space, but
people sleep in the cabin.
Oh, well, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, that's what this couple, when they reached out to me, that's what they let me know is like, they slept in the cabin and they were telling me cool. Like, yeah, they were like, it's not great to sleep in the cabin because there's rats in there and blah, 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 blah. But like, yeah, I guess you could just, the door was open.
Yeah.
You could just kind of go in there and sleep in the, I don't know. It's not the first thing I would think of, but in any case, that was, and actually I know Chris is trying to get back on right now, but it was Chris's wife's birthday. It was Elsha's birthday that day.
I remember that. Yeah.
And we were so high that he actually got a cell signal.
Which is unbelievable. Like, we're in the middle of so many million acres of wilderness.
I don't know how far away that cell tower was, but hundreds maybe a mile.
Yeah, I don't know.
And he was like pulling it down from space or something. And he was FaceTiming his family from the cabin. And they were like, what is going on? Like, where are you? And he's like, oh, I'm at this, this cabin. It's pretty great. And they were like, oh my God. So anyway, so it was world-class, worth the drive. The drive down was just as slow as the drive up.
Yeah.
And by the time we got back down to the like main Magruder corridor, we were, I don't know, what do you think? Like maybe halfway?
I think we were close. I think it's much closer to the end than we realized. Otherwise Chris wouldn't have got cell phone signal.
Yeah. Oh, you're right. Yeah. So maybe we were 2/3 or 3/4.
Well, you know, maybe you're right. What we could do. Yeah, we've got like all this technology at our fingertips. And what we could do is just open up a map and check.
We could do that. Yeah, I actually have it.
I really enjoyed that fire tower at the top. It wasn't just, you know, you have all of those views, but the fire tower itself is like no other fire tower that I've seen. Because most fire towers are at the top of huge lattice works of, they're like up on stilts really high up. This one was just like a shed propped up on some rocks.
Yeah, it felt like it was like built into the rock.
Yeah.
They had these cables coming off of it, probably to keep the structural integrity during the winds and in the winter. But I agree. I've never seen anything like that before. And I guess they didn't need a tower because it was on top of that rock. But I can't imagine what winter's like up there in that cabin. It's so surprising to me that it's still intact.
Here it is.
Okay.
It's actually much closer to Elk City. So it wasn't even halfway.
Yeah. I was going to say it's half at best. So we're halfway through. Let's say we're halfway through. I don't know what time it is now. It's like 3:00 in the afternoon at this point. Because it's like an hour up, an hour down, maybe not quite an hour.
It had to have been earlier than that. Because remember, we ate lunch close to where, close to the Magruder.
You're right. Yeah. You're right. So like, but I think we ate lunch at like 2:00.
Yeah, I think we ate lunch late. So it was probably like just around noon that we went up there. Not even halfway.
So, so then I don't actually remember when we hit Magruder. If it was before or after lunch, I think it was after lunch, but. We hit the actual kind of marker where it kind of commemorates how that trail got its name, which is this guy named Magruder who was murdered. And then his friend came back and kind of avenged his death and brought the murderers to trial. And they were all hanged in Lewiston. It was the first hanging in Idaho. And that's kind of why they named it Magruder, when really it's the Nez Perce trail. It was an old Native American trail. Anyway, we were driving through this stuff, and this to me, this road is so long. There's so much wilderness around you. After a while, it kind of got a little monotonous.
It did. It dragged on, and there's just nothing notable. Like, sure, it's pretty, but we'd already seen everything in 360 degrees going up to the fire tower.
Yeah.
It was just more of that as we went.
Yeah, I kind of wish Burnt Knob was like right at the end. So like, yeah. You know, all that work, and then you get there and you're like, oh, this was worth it.
Yeah.
But it's in the middle. So we got through, we hit pavement, we pulled into this little campground, and this is where something really, yeah, to air up. And this is where something really interesting happened, I think, is that we came across this smoldering fire pit. And we documented, I think we both documented it really well in our videos, but like the thing that makes it so scary to me is that, so number one, there was this fire that was still smoldering, like massively smoldering, a lot of smoke coming out of it. We dumped
really hot, glowing embers, like
two gallons maybe of water.
We definitely did that. Of water. So on video, I had you empty your entire, you had that white 2 gallon, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so yep. You emptied that, and then I went and got the 6 gallon that I had in my truck, and we used, I don't know if we used all of it, but we used some of that as well.
Yeah, it was really bad. And then they had chopped down a tree, a fresh young tree,
green
for
tree.
Firewood. I mean, just things that make you cringe. And, you know, I try not to get super negative or like, you know, judgy when I come across that stuff. This is a scenario I was like, who are these people? How could they have done this?
Yeah. And not only, and so, like, we had just driven through, you know, these tens of thousands of acres of burnt forest and come across this, and I think we were just, you know, that just added to it. That just really pissed us off.
Really. And we took the wood and we put it out, and then the thing that like really made it haunting, I think, is when we got into Darby, we looked up to the horizon and there was a massive forest fire, and that forest fire burned over 100,000 acres out there. And it was started, I think you're the one who did the research on this, it was started because somebody didn't put out a campfire
2 days earlier. 2 days before we were there, it started because of a campfire, an unattended campfire. And that was still burning. That fire was still burning in like October. We were there in July, and they took so long to put that out. I don't know if it was October, September, October, something like that. Like, it was burning for a really long time.
I think when fires start out there in those wilderness areas, they just let them burn.
Yeah.
Because they can't, because it's like, they can't fight it. And there's nothing, like there's no civilization that's in danger. And so I think they just let them burn. And it's so sad, because it would be such a different trip through Magruder if those forests hadn't been scorched. In some ways, it gave us more views. Like, you know, like sometimes you like a burnout forest because you can actually see. Yeah. But there was just a lot. So, okay, come through Darby and fill up with gas. I think you put 25 gallons in or something like that. I can't remember how much.
Yeah, it ended up being like, not as much as I thought. So actually, when I said I was on fumes, I was lying a little bit, because it said my range was like 7 miles, but I still had 6 gallons left in the tank.
That's your Toyota, though. Toyota like thing. Never wants you to run out of gas, so they give you a massive reserve. Yeah. So we're in Darby now. I think that's where we had dinner.
We did. Yeah, we stopped off at what was that? Maybe it wasn't in Darby, but we stopped off on the way in one of those small towns at this little burger restaurant.
Yeah, I remember we got out
$6 or something.
Amazing
burger.
There was we were like in the main street of this little Montana town, and there was like this one restaurant on one side of the street and this other restaurant on the other side of the street. And the restaurant on, let's say, the right side of the street was like full of people, and they had like flags out and looked, it was like, oh, that's where you should go. That's where the people are. And the other one was like this little saloon kind of a place. And we got out and we were looking, we were like kind of deciding where to go. And this guy from across the street on the, like the saloon restaurant goes, he like yells out, and he says something like, if you want a bunch of frozen crap food, you should go over there. If you want real fresh food, come over here.
Wasn't he like the owner or something?
Yeah. We walked over and we were like, who are you? Why would you say that to strangers? And he was like, I own this place. And we were like, okay, I mean, we're just going to get a burger anyway. So wound up being a good dinner. But
it was so good.
Yeah. Well, it was actually, I say a good dinner. It was a great dinner. I don't know what you got. I got a burger and it was amazing.
I'm pretty sure I had a burger too. And it was really, really good. And I do remember, I don't know how much it was, but I remember thinking like, how do they charge this little? Like, it was less than a Big Mac.
Yeah. I think his son was the cook or something. Like, Anyway. So then it's late now. I mean, it's past dinner time. I want to say it's like between 7 and 8 p.m. at this point.
Yeah,
when we leave, when we leave Lolo or leave Darby and drive to Lolo. We get to Lolo and I want to gas up one more time in Lolo. And it's like the sun had just started to set. And in that, you know, in July in Idaho, that means it's probably like 9 o'clock or something like that.
It was definitely blue hour. You know, the sun had set, gone over the horizon. Yeah. It's getting blue, getting dark.
Yeah. And so then we hit this highway stretch between Lolo and the turnoff for the actual kind of Lolo motorway off-road part. And it's a really beautiful drive. And the terrain had changed dramatically. Like even on Magruder, you're in the deep, dark woods, you're in the forest, and it's green, but it's not lush green. When you get just, I don't know what that is, maybe 50 or 60 miles north, it's wet green. It's like, it's denser forest and denser underbrush.
Much denser. Maybe because it hadn't all burned down.
Yeah, that could be. So we get in and we're trying to figure out what to do. And you're like, I know this spot. I've done this before.
Yeah, that's one of the few stretches I have done.
Yeah. And we're like, great. So you took the lead. And we turned off, we got gas again, cause I was nervous about gas cause of the whole Yellow Pine incident. So we got gas again. And we turned off on the actual kind of dirt road, Lolo motorway. And this, honestly, this next hour of driving was one of the most fun the whole trip because it was dark, but it hadn't gotten like super dark, which it did later. And the roads were really good and really fun and kind of hilly and curvy.
Yeah, and it had ripping. Just like an occasional whoop on it that if you hit fast, don't need to say specifics here, but if you hit it fast, sure. it's a lot of fun going over those. I wish we had videoed that more, but at the same time, videoing it would mean slowing down and stopping. So that's why we didn't.
We were doing a leapfrog approach, which we did a few times in terms of filming. Like whoever was out in front would drive and then they would stop and get out and they would drive the cars past. And then whoever was in front would drive forward and drive and film the cars past. And so we did that a bit. And then I remember I learned a lot from you on that particular stretch because it was still within, I'm going to say this for the record, it was still within the window of dusk. But it was very dark and you got the drone out and you, were flying the drone in the relative dark, getting these kind of night shots and incredible night shots of the rig. And I completely ripped you off in a lot of those shots on this video that I posted a few weeks ago where we drove through a bombing range, but that's where like watching you and watching that footage was like, that's how I learned how to get those shots at night. Cause they were just, it was beautiful. And there was a couple moments where like, it was clearly still in the window of dusk because there was this glow coming off the horizon that you don't get to see when you're in your rig, but the drone picks it up. And it was just phenomenal.
I really liked that shot cause we all had our light bars on. So it's us obviously on a ridge line, light bars shining ahead of us. And then you just kind of make out mountains in the background and then this red glow across the horizon.
Yeah. So then you were like, hey guys, I have this really great spot.
Yeah, really great.
and we pull up to it and you're like, oh, I think I misremembered this. This is just a spot for one rig.
I mean, it was a great spot.
Yeah, it was. It was a really great spot. And you were like, you know, maybe I should start putting the numbers on these cam spots, like how many rigs it can hold. And I was like, oh, that's actually, I haven't thought of that either. So we drove, I don't know, maybe another 20 or 30 minutes. And we came up to this campsite that was a Lewis and Clark campsite. I think it was called Winter Camp or something like that. Snowbank. Thank you. Yeah. And you had pulled in. And we were a ways back on the radio and you were like, oh yeah, this is going to be great. It's going to be perfect. And we pull in and it was like, I remember thinking like, what do you mean it's going to be perfect? How in the hell are we going to fit in here? Cause it was tight. Yeah. And you were like, oh, it's no problem guys. Look, put that there. It's going to be great. And we did. And it was, it was tight quarters in terms of like rigs camping together, we were all in rooftop tents. I mean, it wasn't like we were sleeping close to each other. It was just fine. But that was actually a really cool campsite. It was cold that night, I remember. And we had these weird deer around the camp.
Oh yeah.
And you went to bed, dude. Like you went to bed. I don't know when you went to bed because I don't know what time it was. So we got into camp at like 11.
I remember you offered me a bourbon. I was like, yeah, I can't stay up till midnight again.
Yeah. 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 You're like, guys, I don't know what you're doing. You're ruining yourselves, guys. And so Chris and I stayed up for maybe another hour after you went to bed. And this group of deer, it was like a young buck and two does. And they just kept like, I actually ran them off twice. Like I ran after them and ran them off and they would just come back. So it was a little weird that they were, you know, they were there, but I will say that that's the moment that we got out our bear spray. So everyone had bear spray on them.
Yeah. Who was it who was dual wielding bear spray? Was it Chris?
Maybe okay. It was Chris. Yeah.
Two on Chris, his hips, yes. And one on either side. Two bear approach.
And it did feel like bears could come out of the woods at any moment because it was, yeah. It's just one of those places. And you just like, people can think what they want. But like it, when you're out there, like you just, it takes being out there to understand what that feeling is. And it's not like you're scared. It's not a fear. It's a wariness.
Yeah. You just know that that's, I mean, it's a safety thing. You prepare for what is entirely possible. And you know, there's wildlife out in that forest. You know, there are moose out there. You know, there are grizzly bears out there. I have seen a grizzly bear not too far from that spot. So I know they're there.
Yeah. Yeah. I would not like to see a grizzly bear out there.
So that's why you have that bear spray close. Or whatever your chosen preferred method of protection is. Yeah.
I mean, I think bear spray is a universally accepted choice of personal protection from animals, from bears when you're out there. But everybody has their own thing. I think if it's late at night and you've had some bourbon, bear spray is a great choice.
Yeah, I think if you've had some alcohol, that's probably the safer option.
Yeah, yeah. I have had some scenarios where people who have been drinking had firearms at camp and it was not safe. Yeah. So in any case, bear spray, nothing happened. I kind of almost wanted something to happen because it would be interesting, but nothing. It was a totally boring night.
I spent $40 on this bear spray. I want to use it.
I want to use it on something. Chris, hold still. So then the next morning I don't know when we left, but I was so excited to drive the Lolo. I mean, I tend to be just excited about everything, but the Magruder and Lolo were the two highlights for me. And I had no idea what Lolo was. I had no idea, dude. It was cool to be in the deep dark woods, but Lolo was a mess.
Later on, I honestly, the first half of it, I really enjoyed.
Yep.
I think it's prettier than the Magruder. I think it's more interesting than the Magruder. It's tighter. It's more overgrown. It's a little more technical than the Magruder. I just really like it. And I think I find the story a little more interesting as well, especially with the information they have along the way about the whole Lewis and Clark Trail.
Yep.
Do you know how they tracked the Lewis and Clark expedition?
No.
My wife Elizabeth told me this yesterday. Apparently one of the cures for constipation used to be mercury, and they were able to follow these traces of mercury.
What?
Yeah. Citation really? Needed. This came from my wife, who probably got it from TikTok. So I'm just going to present it as fact here, and then you guys, anyone listening can
I just assumed that like they took notes on their
wedding. That might be the sensible answer. I prefer my story.
That's going to do it for this discussion about the Idaho BDR. Please tune in next week where Rob, Chris, and I finish our conversation and finish the trip of the Idaho BDR. And there's a lot of really interesting details that didn't make it into the video. So I think you'll find it really fun, informative, and maybe even a little entertaining. So thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.